We are now ready to move on to the third case of this morning, United States v. Linder. And we'll hear from Mr. Petro.
May it please the Court, my name is Mike Petro, and I'm here on behalf of Michael Linder. Good morning to the Court, and good morning to opposing counsel. Judge, this case primarily concerns the plea agreement and sentencing of Michael Linder that occurred in the Rockford Addition. The Rockford Division of the Northern District of Illinois.
But, of course, Mr. Petro, the first question is whether under subparagraph L of, I think it's Part 6 of this plea agreement, Mr. Petro waived his right.
Linder.
That won't be next week. Yes, Mr. Linder waived his right to take this appeal.
Or actually, I did address that primarily in my reply brief, and
it's paragraph 11. But anyway, yes, I mean the waiver is the big issue. And why didn't you confront this in your opening brief?
In the opening brief, Judge, I allege that the judge became impermissibly involved in plea negotiations between the parties. If you look at the record...
But did you move to set aside the guilty plea in the district court?
Well, I've looked at this very carefully, Judge. I don't think there is an opportunity in this particular situation to even move to set aside the plea agreement. What you have here is a...
Why can you say that when you had a whole sentencing proceeding at the end of which, you know, the judge pronounces sentence, and, I mean, at some point along the way, under your theory, if you think the judge was inserting himself too much into the process, say by asking for briefs on the number of victims or by asking for input on whether he should be considered a leader or a manager or these various other issues, it seems to me there's every opportunity to call this question to the district court's attention.
Well, Judge, I would just say with respect to that, there's two issues there. Rule 11 provides a process and procedure for a district court judge to reject a plea. He says that the agreement is too low. He should have advised the parties that he is going to give a substantially higher sentence, a 125% higher sentence, and sent the parties back and say he's rejecting the plea.
But he doesn't have to. He warned the defendant repeatedly that under the language of this agreement, and that's where I do mean Part 6L, that defendant acknowledges that the calculations are preliminary, that first the probation office and then the court will determine the facts and law. The validity of the agreement is not contingent on the court's concurrence with those calculations. How many more times does the judge have to say it? What the subpart C part of this particular plea agreement is the 5K motion for the 50% discount, but it doesn't commit anybody to what the initial guideline level is.
What I would say, Judge, is first I want to state that in this particular case it's clear that the judge has conditionally accepted the plea based on whether or not he's going to grant the 5K and a lot of other things.
And but judges conditionally accept pleas like this all the time where the plea agreement itself says the defendant understands it's going to be up to the court to compute sentencing guidelines. I can't tell you how many cases this court sees where defendants like your client are disappointed, one could say, really disappointed, because the judge figures out that various enhancements exist, the judge decides there's relevant conduct that wasn't taken into account, the judge decides that there are amounts of loss that weren't taken into account. Depends on the case, but it happens not infrequently that the judge calculates something that's higher than the level that the parties initially thought as reflected in the plea agreement.
I agree, but it's not the judge's role to act as a prosecutor to determine that the plea is unsatisfactory with respect to the sentence.
That's not what the judge is doing.
And then essentially bait the government into asking for a higher sentence, which voids the whole plea agreement at that point.
No, that's not what the judge is doing. The plea agreement itself says it's going to be up to the judge to calculate the advisory guideline range to come up with a sentence. The judge is now responsible for doing that, and the judge says, I need facts, I need input to carry out this responsibility. The judge isn't upsetting anybody's negotiations. It is possible, of course, to put a plea in front of a court that right down to the month says this is the sentence that we have negotiated, but that's not this plea.
Well, when the judge advised Mr. Linder at the time that he accepted his plea, he essentially said that this plea is for 39 months. What is the reasonable defendant supposed to assume when he's promised 39 months and he goes to court and he gets 84 months?
I don't think he was promised 39 months. I think the judge tried to say, I am going to have to take a look at this. You don't think that's, I mean, it's in the transcripts. The judge warns him.
Well, I think at some point, Judge, when you get to the point, I mean, we have to put this into the context that Michael Linder is a cooperating witness for the government. What the district judge here is doing is he's weighing in on the benefit of the cooperation that the government has provided Mr. Linder under these circumstances. This is a substantially different circumstance because the government and the defendant have agreed that based on all the factors, this was an investigation and a cooperation that existed for years. This was a substantially negotiated plea. They agreed to everything that in turn for giving up his 3553A factors, for giving up his right to go to trial, for giving up his right to go to the grand jury, this is what his sentence would be.
But
they changed their position clearly.
But that's not the kind of plea agreement he gets. Rule 11C1C says that the parties can agree that a specific sentence, among other things, is the appropriate disposition. If you had that kind of plea agreement, we wouldn't really even be here. I think the judge would have either rejected the plea agreement or he would have entered that sentence. But that's not what you have.
I don't think, on information and belief, Judge, I don't think that particular district court will even countenance that type of plea agreement.
No, but he's misled, at least. I mean, it is available in the rules, though, and it's not how this plea agreement reads.
Judge, you entered a dissent, I believe, in a case like this where you stated clearly that I don't really think...
I don't know what we can do with it.
I don't think that defendants really negotiate for a plea waiver at all. What they negotiate for is the amount of time that they're giving in return for giving up substantial rights. And that's what we have here. The only thing that a defendant sees when he goes in and pleads guilty is 39 months. Now, something clearly goes wrong. The judge says this is too low.
No, the judge has a responsibility. And even the Supreme Court, in cases as recent as United States against Gall, United States against Kimbrough, has said the judge must calculate the guidelines properly to get the right advice, if you will. And under this plea agreement, the judge had a responsibility to satisfy himself that he had correctly applied the guidelines. At that point, this particular plea agreement said a 50% discount will happen, which did happen. It's just from, as you point out, from a higher starting number.
Well, with respect to this particular case, the government and the defendant have substantial negotiations, and they determine that the guideline range is 78 months, 50% off, 39. The pre-sentence report in this...
What do you think the language in the plea agreement saying none of this is binding means?
Well, the pre-sentence report in this particular case, though, Judge, comes back with a lower number, 70 months.
What do you think the language in paragraph 6L means? It's a page 17 of the plea agreement. I don't see separate pages in this appendix. Because it seems to me that both parties have to take the plea agreement as a whole, both the estimated calculation and this reservation in paragraph 6L. And what does it mean?
By brief, Judge, it mentions that an appeal waiver in a criminal case is normally valid and binding, but there are exceptions. And in this particular case,
That's not the paragraph I'm asking you about. I'm assuming for the sake of argument that the appeal waiver isn't going to apply. And I'm looking at the acknowledgement that the sentencing guidelines calculations are preliminary in nature and that the court's determinations will govern the final calculation. The validity of the agreement is not contingent. What did that language mean to you? How does that square with your argument about the fixed nature of the 39-month estimate?
That means that the facts and negotiations between the parties and everything regarding burden of proof issues and things along those lines was negotiated by the parties.
But then
At some point, the government changes their position and adds additional facts that were not presented to Mr. Linder at the time of the plea.
Correct. And why doesn't the language saying that he understands that the probation office is going to conduct its own investigation and that the court will ultimately determine the facts, why hasn't he acknowledged that this very thing could happen?
The probation office, in this particular case, came up with a lower number.
But
and
the
reason.
Didn't. Right?
Well, the court is not absolute. We have an adversarial system of justice for a reason. And in this particular case, what happened was a plea agreement was negotiated. The probation office comes up with a lower number. The government never complains and says, hey, wait a second, you have a lower number here. You've misapplied the guidelines. The judge comes into court and says, look, this number's too low. I'm rejecting this plea agreement. End of story. Go back to the drawing board because there's all these other facts and issues that need to be addressed before you can come to this court and ask me to sentence fairly Michael Linder. That did not happen here. What happened here is he said, I want you to address these issues, and I want you to change these facts, at which point the government dutifully addressed those facts and came into court and asked for 84 months as opposed to 39 months. The variance between the amount that's negotiated here and the amount of time that Michael Linder actually receives is outrageous.
What remedy are you seeking?
To remand to the district court, vacate the plea agreement, that under these circumstances, Michael Linder could not have knowingly and voluntarily, possibly under any circumstances, reasonably foreseen this outcome. And
Was there a motion to withdraw the plea?
Well, that's what I wanted to get to. If you look at withdrawing the plea, if you look in 11D...
I think that's a no, actually. There was no motion. Yeah.
There was no motion. But when would he have done this? If you look at 11D, it says before the court accepts the plea, for any reason or no reason, after the court accepts the plea, but before it imposes sentences, it says for a fair and just reason.
So
they impose sentence and accept the plea at the same time. When would he have done that? Sometime between...
Afterward.
He can't.
There's rules that permit that. He'd have to find some way to get out from the conclusive language in the agreement, but... You know, he instead takes an appeal that's prohibited by the agreement and makes the argument here that he wants to unwind the plea. And I have a question about whether that's what he really wants here. He wants to unwind this plea and go back to...
Absolutely, Judge.
Square one and risk a higher sentence?
That's correct, Judge. That's what Mr. Linder wants to do.
Like to save a little rebuttal time.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. McKenzie?
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm John McKenzie for the United States. Your Honor, Judge, you hit it right on the nose. It's a really fairly simple case, one that's come up before this Court on repeated occasions. The only thing that's a little different about this is, unlike most times it comes up where the sentencing calculations are different than the plea agreement, the defendant complains that they're too high, determines them correctly. This one actually has a waiver of appeal on top of it. So we have the overlay of that. The original plea agreement reached by the government and the defendant was clear. It was 50% off of the low end of the guideline range. And that range would be whatever the court determined it to be. It was a
I guess the reason that Ms. plain error or whatever to one side, I think the reason Mr. Petro is trying to get at the heart of the plea agreement is if he can get rid of the plea agreement itself, he can get rid of the waiver too, right? If there's some reason to think that the plea agreement was not knowingly and appropriately entered into.
That's correct. It's a little backwards because he starts doing that at the point of his reply brief.
Reply brief, yes.
And bringing it in his initial brief. And setting aside any waiver problems of that, it still doesn't work. Even the reasons he gives in his reply brief for setting aside that really don't indicate that it was involuntary. He simply indicates that the government used proffered information in violation of a proffer letter, and somehow the court was involved in that. The court's right. Judge Reinhart repeatedly discussed with him about this waiver, about the calculation of the sentencing guidelines.
Judge Reinhart also brought out the fact that there was an appellate waiver, as I recall.
He did. He's very careful, as the court could look at from the plea transcript. Several times he brought out, this depends upon how I calculate the guidelines, not the government, not your defense counsel. They've agreed tentatively it's 39 months after the 50% reduction, but that's not binding on me. I'll make the decisions. And so at that point, he comes in before sentencing, and you've got to realize there's related cases going on throughout. One was the Kistine case decided by this court. Another one's the Burdekka case, which we referred to. It didn't come up on appeal. Burdekka case was being sentenced on November 17th. Burdekka was giving kickbacks to Mr. Linder in order to get securities business for these pension funds. Right before that date of the Burdekka sentencing, Judge Reinhart looks at that and now issues orders in the Linder case saying, gee, these issues are coming up in the Burdekka case I'm preparing for sentencing on. I need you to address defense counsel and government how they affect Mr. Linder's sentence, because there's additional relevant conduct now that before really wasn't provable by the government. But at some point after Mr. Burdekka pleaded guilty, government now had enough, and the court realized the government had enough to prove additional relevant conduct in the form of the $100,000+ in kickback.
$1,000, yeah.
And so that's the interlay between the Burdekka case and this, Your Honor.
We've actually got two cases here, and the appeal waiver in the second one, which we haven't really talked about yet, is phrased a little bit differently.
Yes, sir.
And is contingent upon the guidelines range actually coming in at a certain level, 6 to 12 months, which didn't happen.
Correct.
And so I take it that because the sentence in that case was concurrent, we've got a harmless error situation?
Well, you're right.
To the extent that there were any errors?
It really doesn't make any difference. There really weren't any errors. In fact, in the brief, he doesn't complain of any errors on the 04 CR case. So he's really not complaining about that. What he's really trying to do is set aside his 06 CR case. And so the court's right. He did reserve his right to appeal because the guideline range calculated by the court was one level higher because of a change in the guidelines version. So that's why that was that point.
I know this gets a little bit off what we were talking about, but I do want to know this. As far as this annuity, the annuities that were purchased as opposed to the, I guess, investment in what was self-directed?
Mutual funds, yes, sir.
Yeah, and so I assume these annuities have value.
Yes, sir, they do.
And so I guess it comes down to whether that's a defined benefit or defined contribution or something. I guess that an annuity is a defined benefit, isn't it?
These were, I believe, mostly out of the defined benefit funds, although some of them were defined contribution funds.
Okay, well, I don't know about all that mishmash, but I assume that even though he took a big premium and got a lot of money back that he wouldn't otherwise have gotten if this had been through the self-directed whatever it was, that they did get some benefit from the investment.
Yes, sir. They did have their own accounts established. It wasn't the case of somebody simply taking all the money and running.
It wasn't a Ponzi scheme or something. The money's going somewhere else.
Correct. Yeah. These annuities, the mutual funds had very little commission, very lean contracts.
Right.
The annuities, on the other hand, were loaded with commissions, and that's where he was able to actually direct how much commission. After the court went ahead and asked for the parties' opinions and said, what about these different facts? How do they relate to Mr. Linder? The government weighed in. Defense counsel indicates that the government tried to somehow curry favor with Judge Reinhart and fall in lockstep with his order, and that's really unfair. It's not borne out by certainly his own counsel at sentencing, who agreed with the government on many of its points. It's not borne out by the fact we disagreed with the court on some issues. So it wasn't that we were in lockstep with Judge Reinhart. We were asked to look, research, find additional facts, present additional law and reason, and we did so. In the very end, the court did what the parties asked him to do. The court accepted the plea agreement, accepted the Rule 11 C1C aspect of it, and gave the defendant exactly what was contained in the plea agreement, 50% off of the low end of the sentencing guideline range as calculated by the court.
I suppose you don't want to be in the prediction business, but if we were to vacate this plea and send things back to the trial court, I suppose anything from a full trial to a newly negotiated plea or anything else could happen, which might or might not include a 5K reduction like that.
You're right, Your Honor. I would rather not be a predictor of the future. I'm tough at explaining the present, much less the future.
Right.
Your Honor, on the other issues, I'd be glad to rest on my brief unless the court has specific questions on the other issues. Otherwise, I would ask that this court dismiss the appeal in the 06 CR case because of the appellate waiver, and in any event, affirm the sentences and convictions.
I'll just ask one more question.
Yes, sir.
For what length of time was this going on, with his getting these extraordinary commissions?
I believe it was around a 3 to 4 year period that it took place with the Nationwide. There was a preceding a predecessor company that, but we didn't go into that, whether that was loaded up as well with the commissions. It looked like most of it was from Nationwide Life Insurance Annuities. So somewhere around a 3 year, maybe just a little more than a 3 year period.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, you had a little time. About a minute.
Judge, just briefly, the court is to allow this plea agreement to stand. Effectively, what you're telling all criminal defense counsel is that you're forever bound by the agreement, but the government can do whatever they want. And I would just say that when a defendant enters a plea, it should not be just slightly more than the audacity of hope. It should be something that he can count on, that when he and the government shake hands and agree on 39 months, that the government's not going to come back and recommend a sentence substantially higher based on new facts or facts that were not contemplated at the time of the agreement. What should have happened here is the plea agreement should have been rejected, just like it was rejected in the O'Neill case. The judge should have sent everyone back to the drawing board and said, these are the facts that need to be addressed. You guys have an agreement. I don't like the agreement. And that's the way that Rule 11 should work. But to allow it to work in this particular fashion, I think, in effect, gives the appearance that you can be tricked into pleading guilty. You can have an attractive plea agreement by a prosecutor that says 39 months, and then once you bait the hook and you start reeling in, you say, oh, well, by the way, the judge doesn't really like this plea agreement, and you know what? He's right.
Okay, I think we have your point, and we thank you very much.
Thank you,
Judge. We will take the case under advisement.